The verses that I want you to consider with me are found in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and the first seven verses. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and the first seven verses. In the New King James Version, page 1117, and in the NIV, page 809 in the pews. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and beginning to read at verse 1. Let's hear these verses. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment, for I wish that all men were even as I myself, but each one has his own gift from God. One in this manner and another in that. We thank God for the reading of his word. We've already introduced this chapter in a previous sermon and indeed introduced the rest of the letter by showing that there are five statements made by the Corinthians. And each one of these great statements touch on an important area of the Christian life. The first is concerning marriage. We find it in chapter 7. Second concerns Christian freedom, and Paul deals with this in chapters 8 to 10. The third concerns worship, and especially spiritual gifts and prophecy in the church. Paul deals with that in chapters 12 to 14. The fourth concerns a collection for the saints, and Paul deals with that in chapter 16. And then the fifth concerns Apollos, the man who was one of the teachers for a time in Corinth. And again, Paul deals with that in chapter 16. So there's five areas of Christian living. And what Paul does is he deals thoroughly with each one of these concerns. And in doing so, he's always showing us that the gospel changes lives. He shows us that true Christianity is not just about what you think, it's about how you live. And more than that, he shows us that Christ, when he comes into our lives, totally transforms those lives. Our lives can never be the same again once Jesus has come into our lives. The gospel has power. It has power to change your life. And that life will be changed if Christ is in you. So here in 1 Corinthians 7, it's a long way into the letter. There have been many other things that have been more important, and he's dealt with them already. But by the time he gets to chapter 7, he begins to deal with these issues that they have raised with him in a letter. And the first one is the relationship of marriage. And I want you to notice a few things by way of introduction. First of all, there are two ways of understanding the first verse. And we need to face up to that. Because the way we understand it is going to very much affect the way we interpret the rest of this chapter. So the first way to understand it is this. Paul says, now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. So the first way is to understand this in terms of this being Paul. This is Paul's view. It's Paul's idea. That Paul is saying, as far as I'm concerned, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, if you think that, then you're going to understand the rest of the chapter as Paul defending this idea that it's good for a man not to touch a woman. We'll get to what that means in a minute. But that's one way of understanding these verses, that Paul actually does believe that it is a good thing for a man not to have marital relations with a woman. Now, there is another way of understanding it, and that is that this is the Corinthians saying this, that this is actually what they have written to him, that it is another one of the Corinthians' slogans. We've already discovered that they love their slogans. They have reduced their Christianity to a set of very short sound bites. They would be quite at home in our news culture, where all the politicians are trying to get that one sentence that will get on the news and everyone will remember it. And the Corinthians were like that. They reduced their Christianity to this series of short statements. And that one of these statements is this. They wrote to Paul and they said, as far as we're concerned, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, I want to suggest to you that that is the correct way of understanding this first verse. And if we understand it like that, the rest of the chapter makes perfect sense. This is the Corinthians making a statement. And this is the conclusion that they've come to. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. So that's the first thing that I would say. And that's how I'm going to understand the passage, that this is what the Corinthians believe. Second point of introduction. I want you to notice how restrained Paul is in his language, in the words that he chooses when he's describing something that is very private, something that is very intimate. It's quite the opposite of what we hear today and what we see in printed material. We live in a very crude society. We live in an explicit culture. And these sort of things are just mentioned, and all sorts of words are used that really ought never to be used. The Bible is quite the opposite of that. The Bible is always very veiled when it comes to a relationship between a man and a woman, that intimate relationship. Even in the Old Testament, the very first chapters of the Bible, we read that Adam knew his wife Eve. And that is just a normal word for knowing somebody, a really close knowledge. Some of the modern versions choose to be more explicit in their language, as if we don't really know what's being spoken of. But Paul is very careful. He's veiled. He uses euphemisms. And sometimes they sound very quaint in our society, but they're not. They're showing that here is a godly man who's using necessary delicacy when dealing with something that's very personal, very private, the relationship between a husband and a wife. He says, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, he doesn't mean just touch, does he? He means to cling to hold, to have that intimate relationship with. And then he says later on that the husband is to show due affection for his wife, and the wife must render the affection to her husband. He says what is due, what is obligated. And again, he doesn't even use the word affection. He's just saying about what is right and proper within a marriage relationship. And I want you to notice that, because I think that sometimes we can give in to the crudity of the culture around us. And the Corinthians were living in a crude culture, and they would have been hearing all sorts of language. And Paul chooses very careful words to use. And then another thing in terms of the introduction. The slogan seems a bit strange, doesn't it, to us, if we're honest. Why would anyone think that it was good for a man not to touch a woman? Why would anyone think that it was a good thing not to be married? Why would anyone think it was a good thing, even within that marriage, not to have these intimate relationships? Why did the Corinthians ever think about that? Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is their faulty understanding of what it means to be a Christian. Somehow they had come to the conclusion that the body is impure and that any physical contact is somehow dirty and sinful. This idea developed later on into a full-blown heresy where people believed that the body and the spirit were very separate entities and that the body was sinful, but the spirit was somehow pure and could be redeemed. And so later on, not really in the Corinthians' time, but later on, that's how it developed into a full-blown heresy. That's not what Christianity says at all. They'd misunderstood. They got this idea that somehow the body and physical things are sinful and bad, and so to abstain from them is obviously a pure thing. But I think there's another reason. There's another reason why they'd come to this conclusion, and it's because of the culture they were living in. And they were in a crisis situation where the Roman and Greek culture had clashed enormously with Christianity. So when they went out into the marketplace every day, when they were out at work in Corinth, what did they see? Well, they saw an awful lot of prostitution and a terrific amount of abuse, particularly from men to women. They lived in a sensual culture where physical desire and pleasure was considered to be the most important pursuit, and everything was permitted. There were no holds barred when it came to their culture and when it came to sexual matters. So there was extramarital relationships, there was premarital relationships, there was homosexuality, there was adultery, there was pornography, there was prostitution, and a lot worse. Just like the culture that we live in. All of the things that we see were there. You go to what we call the red light districts of our towns and cities, that's what Corinth was like as well. And it was coming at them through their culture all the time. Now, what they had thought is, surely, now we're Christians, it's better for us to keep right away from all of that. Surely, being Christians means we've got to be different. And being different means that we should keep as far away as possible from all of that sinful, immoral stuff. And they'd also come to the conclusion it's better to keep away from that even within a married relationship. Perhaps if you're married, they thought, it's better to avoid intimate relationships. And if you're married to an unbeliever, then perhaps the best thing is to get divorced. And if you're planning to marry, perhaps it's better to call off the wedding. And if you're single or you're widowed, well, perhaps the best thing is for you to stay the way that you are. So you see the way they were thinking. Their culture around them had led them to a conclusion that it's surely better to avoid all of this because it is so sinful. And they'd also misunderstood Christianity. Paul has to correct all of that. But notice the way that Paul does it. He answers in a gloriously comprehensive way. It's quite a long chapter, isn't it? He doesn't just dismiss their slogan. It would be easy to do that. I think we might be tempted to do that. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. Don't be so ridiculous, we say. That's rubbish. Paul doesn't do that. He treats it very seriously because there is a very serious reason why they'd come to that misunderstanding. He deals with it, noting that they were right in certain areas, and he commends them for it, but they were very wrong in others. So Paul is incredibly comprehensive. If you read this chapter, I would encourage you to read the chapter and to read it many times. But if you read the chapter, you will find yourself in this chapter somewhere. That's the glorious nature of this chapter. When he's dealing with marriage, he deals with every possible situation that we find ourselves in. Are you married? You find yourself here. Are you a married man? You're here. Are you a married woman? You're here. Are you a single man? You're here. Are you a single woman? You're here. Are you a widower? You're here. Are you a widow? You're here. Are you divorced? A divorced man? You're here. A divorced woman? You're here as well. Are you a man who's married to an unbelieving wife? You're here. Are you a woman married to an unbelieving husband? You're here. Are you engaged to be married? You're here. Are you a young person wondering about the future? You're here. Are you children where one parent is a believer and the other parent isn't a believer? You're here. It's quite incredible the way that the Apostle Paul, in his masterful way, inspired by the Holy Spirit, he deals with every possible situation of every one of his readers. And the chapter isn't just about marriage. It must be like a dear lady when I was growing up in our church. We always called her Auntie Louie. She was, I expect she was probably Louise, but she was always Auntie Louie. And she was always old, and everybody called her Auntie Louie. And she'd been a single lady all of her life. And one of our elders decided to preach on Ephesians chapter 5 about marriage. And he did it over several weeks. And every Sunday, she would say after the service, "Well, there's nothing there for me. Nothing there for me." Because she wasn't married. Well, there was an awful lot there for her, but she just didn't see it. But you can't say that about this chapter, because it's not just about marriage. If we're Christians, then we are meant to struggle in our lives with what it means for Jesus Christ to be Lord of every area of our life. So in these first seven verses, what Paul does is he masterfully shows us that becoming a Christian means that God begins to undo the curse of sin in our lives. When the gospel takes root in your life and changes you, you begin to be restored to what God always intended. That's what being a Christian does. Being a Christian begins to undo the effects of the curse of sin. It will never be completely undone in this world. We have to wait till we get to glory for the complete reversal. But even here on earth, becoming a Christian, knowing Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit working in your life, means that the curse of sin begins to unravel. And that is true of marriage, as it is about everything else. So let's remind ourselves of what sin did to marriage. Because sin absolutely devastated the marriage relationship. That's why we read Genesis chapter 3. The relationship between Adam and Eve before the fall into sin in Genesis 3 was a perfect marriage relationship. But the fall into sin changed all of that. Sin damaged that relationship between Adam and Eve, between husband and wife. We read that there was shame and guilt. So in Genesis 3 verse 7, the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. Why did they do that? Because they were covering up from each other. It wasn't that they were covering themselves from God. He hadn't yet arrived in the garden. They felt this shame and guilt, and they felt this need to cover themselves. And then in verse 10, Adam says to the Lord God, "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself." The shame and the guilt that came into the world and affected that marriage relationship. Not only that, but sin caused them to blame other people for their wrongdoing. So God speaks to Adam, and you notice what he says, "The woman you gave to me." the woman you gave. So it's not my fault, it's her fault. And actually it's your fault too, because you gave her to me. And then what does the woman say? The serpent deceived me and I ate. So there's this constant desire to push the blame onto somebody else. And that comes within the marriage relationship. And so a husband will blame the wife for all the problems that they're having. And a wife will blame the husband for all the problems that they're having, rather than saying, well, hey, what have I done? Perhaps it is me. Sin brought a curse on their relationship. And a very important verse for us in the context of marriage is Genesis 3 and verse 16. Very, very important verse for us to understand. Genesis 3, verse 16. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. And this is the phrase we need to understand. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Your desire shall be for your husband. What does that mean? Well, exactly the same phrase, exactly the same phrase is used in chapter 4 and verse 7 to do with Cain. If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Exactly the same phrase. Its desire is for you. Sin's desire is to master you. Sin's desire is to get the better of you. Sin's desire is to take control of you. And it's exactly the same phrase. Your desire shall be for your husband. It will be your desire from now on to master him and to take control of the relationship. From now on, that is what it will be. You'll be striving for that sort of relationship. But what about the husband? Well, sin affects him as well. He shall rule over you in the sense of harshness and domineering and not lovingly. You see, it's changed everything. Sin changes everything. This wonderful relationship that there should have been has now changed, and their desires and their relationship with each other is going to be severely affected. God's plan for marriage was a healthy relationship of love, expressed by the man loving his wife sacrificially and the wife submitting to her husband's role as loving leader. And sin turned all of that upside down. And we see this even in Eve's decision to go ahead without consulting her husband and to eat what was forbidden. She took on the role of leader in the relationship. Of course, that's why Satan targeted her, because it was an overturning of God's order. He didn't go to Adam, he went to Eve. And then she willingly took on that role of being the leader. But Adam is also at fault, because he was standing right there next to Eve when all this is happening. She took the fruit and ate it, and she gave to her husband who was with her. So he remained silent, whereas a loving husband in a leadership role should have said to her, we can't do that. And lovingly he should have prevented it, but he didn't. And that has had an enormous effect on marriage. Mrs. Blenkinsop thinks that her husband is really useless at making decisions. So what does she do? She takes charge and she makes all the decisions. Mr. Blenkinsop thinks that his wife is a tiresome nag, so he neglects her and invests no time in their relationship at all. And that's just one example. And to some extent or other, every relationship is affected by sin. And at worst, we find husbands who control their wives and treat their wives as slaves. Or wives who control their husbands and beat them into the ground. And there is abuse, even within this most glorious of relationships. So how does Christ and his lordship change all that? That's what Paul comes to in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And he tells us three
glorious things. What happens when you become a Christian to your marriage? Number one, marriage, as God intended, means equality. You realize, once you come to Christ, that marriage is a union which is equal. Whereas sin often ends up with one partner being dominant and the other one being downtrodden, Christian marriage recognizes the equality of a man and his wife as created beings in the presence of God. There is no sense in a Christian marriage that one partner is inferior and the other is superior when it comes to our relationship with God, and we treat one another as equals. Paul speaks to each of the marriage partners every time he makes a point. Did you notice that? It gets a little bit tiresome at some points. But you notice that the Corinthians are saying, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. They are very much male-dominated, aren't they? The man's the important one. He's the one. And for many, many decades, our society has been male-dominated. It's no wonder that the women are saying, hey, we're not having that. And there's something very right about women saying, we're not having this male domination. We want more equality. There's something very right about that. Sadly, it's possibly going to go the other way, which is how societies go, isn't it? But this is what the Corinthians say. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. They don't say it's good for a woman not to touch a man. But Paul will have none of that. Every time he makes a point, he wants to show the absolute fairness and equality between a husband and a wife. So, verse 2. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife. And let each woman have her own husband. Equality. Verse 3. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her. And likewise also the wife to her husband. Absolute fairness. Verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Absolute equality. The glorious way in which Paul just gently says to us, hold on a minute. There's husband and wife, and before God, they are equal, with equal rights and equal obligations. The two shall become one. So marriage, as God intended it, is a relationship of equality. And the second thing that Christianity does is it restores this. Marriage, as God intended, means mutual respect. Sin destroys respect. They had no self-respect, did they? They had no respect for God. And it destroys respect for God, and it destroys respect for creation and for other human beings as well. Why? Because sin is selfishness in the end. And what the gospel does, when Jesus comes into our lives, the gospel works in order to develop this respect for others. And that is especially true in the marriage relationship. It's true of every relationship. When you become a Christian, you begin to see other people as creations of God, made in the image of God, precious to God. You see every other human being as someone who possesses an eternal soul. And that causes you to have great respect, even for people who are extremely wicked. You still respect the fact that they are made in the image of God. And that's especially true within marriage. There has to be respect for the other partner. And again, Paul brings this out so wonderfully, doesn't he? Let the husband, he says, let the husband render to his wife the affection due to her. Husband, you've got certain obligations to your wife. You must care for her. You must love her.
You have physical obligations towards her. Give her the things that you must give her. And show her respect in that. And then he says to the wife, now you've got to do exactly the same thing because you also have obligations to your husband. Care for him, to love him. And you have physical obligation. Give them. Now notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, husband, you can demand certain things of your wife. It's always the same in the Bible. The Bible never tells you to demand something from somebody else. It always tells you that you have an obligation to give. So the gospel does that. It makes us realize that there is a mutual respect for one another. There are obligations put upon us to love one another and to seek to fulfill the needs and the desires of the other person, to think of them. And that's what Christian marriage is about. It's not about you, it's about them. And there's a respect. And even when it comes to times of abstinence, as he says in verse 5, this is a mutual decision. This isn't a decision that one person takes. It's a mutual decision, he says, with consent for a time. So marriage, as God intended, means mutual respect. And then finally, the gospel changes marriage because we come to understand that marriage, as God intended, means self-giving. You see, sin is selfishness. The devil said to Eve, "You will be like God." And when Eve saw that it was good for food, so it was going to satisfy her desire, her hunger. And when she saw it was pleasant to the eyes, she saw it and it looked good. And when she knew it was desirable to make her wise, those selfish lusts within her said, "I want it, I want it, I want it." And it was very selfish. And that's what sin does. It makes us entirely self-centered, and everything in the world has got to revolve around me and satisfy my needs. And we live in a culture that says that that's true. The culture says to you, you are the most important person and you deserve certain things. And the world needs to give you those things and other people need to give you those things. And if they don't, then you've got every right to kick off. And the gospel says, actually, that is completely untrue. That is sin. That is sin. Rather, we must give of ourselves. A television program a few years ago, I was really struck by this. It's amazing what you can see on these television programs. There was a character who was thinking about marriage. A friend came to see him. It's quite obvious that this character is in no way suited to get married. He would be a complete disaster. But he was engaged to get married to this lovely lady. And so the friend comes along and says to him, "Well, you know the most important question that you've got to ask yourself before you get married?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, I know that. I know the question. The question is, can she make me happy?" And his friend said, "That's not the question. The question is, can you make her happy?" And that's true, isn't it? It's, what can I do? Now, you see, so many marriages that fail because this is overturned. She's not making me happy anymore. And so I deserve better, and I can get better somewhere else, and so I'm going to go there. No, what can you do? It's about giving. It's about self-giving, being willing to think of them and their needs, to relinquish authority over your own body even, and to give it up to the other person. And of course, that's a remedy for immorality, isn't it? A strong and satisfying, self-giving marriage. And we see that demonstrated so clearly in Christ. Because didn't the Lord Jesus Christ give himself up for the church? He gave himself completely for the church. And in the same way, he says, husbands, you're to love your wives like that. You're to be willing to give yourselves up and even to give your life for her. Because that's the way Christ loves the church. And wife, you are to give yourself to your husband. Just as the church submits to Christ, so the wife is to give herself to her husband. There's a mutual self-giving.
And that's a glorious thing in marriage. Now, no marriage is perfect in this world. No Christian marriage is perfect in this world. But Christian marriages have so much potential because the gospel has been at work in us. And so we see marriage differently. We see our marriage partner differently. And we understand what it means to really love someone. It means not to demand, but to give, just as Christ loved the church. And as we do that, the curse begins to unravel. As wives submit to their husbands in love, rather than desiring to master and control them. And when husbands love their wives, considering their happiness and their needs, rather than wanting to harshly rule over them, well, we begin to see the curse unfolding. But we mustn't forget Paul's last verse. Verse 7, marriage isn't everything. Don't forget that. Marriage isn't everything. Verse 7, I wish that all men were even as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Paul wasn't married when he wrote to Corinthians. And he says, marriage is great, but it's not everything. The more important thing is to seek God. And if he's given you the gift not to be married, well, that's a good thing as well. Well, it's tough, isn't it? But it's full of potential by the grace of God working in our lives to show the world that there is another way to live, even within that glorious married relationship. Well, may God bless his word to our